filming everything, the people, the buildings, the night sky. After a while, he said there was no tape in his camera. I wouldn't say it was your average normal dinner conversation. Like, oh, you live in Switzerland, what's your favorite thing about the Alps? But there was nothing disappointing about meeting this particular idol. His personality was every bit as strange and captivating as his records. Soon after, we were working on the Hello Nasty album at a studio on Downing Street in the West Village. A lot of our material at the time came out of just basically jamming an idea. We had this one unfinished song that revolved around an organ line by keyboard Money Mark, a bass line that Yauch played, and a beat that I had made with a big kick drum in G-Sun's live room with the parquet floor. Perry's productions were always the primary reference for us with that song, but we didn't have what it took to finish it, a vocal idea, a hook, the thing that could take it from a sort of idea to an actual song. We tried a couple of directions, but nothing really got it there. We liked it, but we couldn't quite figure out how to finish it. We had our dry erase board up with a list of all these songs in various stages of construction, and that one just sat there. Then we heard Perry was doing a show on Halloween at a club in Tribeca called Wetlands. Mario Caldata, our co-producer on Hello Nasty, really started pushing. Lee Scratch Perry is coming to New York. We got to get him in and see if he has some ideas. Long story short, Perry agreed to give us a few hours between soundcheck and showtime on the night of that Halloween show. The day of the show arrived, and it turned out we'd overlooked one minor detail. Halloween, in the West Village, is a huge fucking deal. There's always a massive parade. You've got tens of thousands of people, maybe more, dressed to the nines. People of all colors, all persuasions, all preferences, letting their freak flags fly. Sixth Avenue gets closed. It's very difficult to get around. Forget driving. So now we had this very small window of time with Lee Perry, but he basically can't get a cab. So it was decided that Yauch and Mario would go down to the World Trade Center, where his hotel was, and bring him back through the thick of the Halloween parade. Yauch and Mario dutifully showed up at the hotel and told Lee and his manager that the only way to get back was to take the train. The manager was immediately like, "What? You're going to take Lee Scratch Perry on that train? No." But Perry, with his worldly calm, simply said, "It's fine, it's fine." So the three of them took the train. Then they had to walk through masses of people from the station to the studio. The amazing part is, the way most people dress for Halloween is the way Lee Perry dresses every day. He had rainbow-dyed hair and beard, and was wearing a super tall baseball hat that was covered in mirrors and broken glass and buttons and boots to match. Every bit of his outfit was covered with something. He'd stand out 364 days of the year, but he was perfectly camouflaged to walk through the middle of the Halloween parade in the West Village. After many hours, miraculously, they walked into the studio. We played Perry a little bit of what we were working on. We were all very nervous about it, because the song was kind of inspired by him. He could easily just have turned around and said, "Fire, burn," and wandered off into the parade. Thankfully, he seemed good with it. We didn't know where to begin, so Mario started handing him random percussion instruments, and he did several takes playing them. We all had this holy shit fan moment when we realized that that was actually him playing percussion on a lot of his productions. You could just tell from the way he played. Then Mario sheepishly handed him a vocal mic and said, "Hey, why don't you try this?" His singing was also revelatory, because we realized that on his productions, it's often his voice. On so many of the records he produced, it's impossible to tell who's singing what. But just hearing his phrasing, we realized how much of it was actually him. All told, we got 2 or 3 hours out of him in the studio. As sort of out there as he is, he got it done right. He was a consummate professional. He did what a session player would do if he said, "Hey, be Lee Scratch Perry." The track finally had what it needed to become a song, and it ended up on Hello Nasty, Dr. Lee, Ph.D. After we finished the session, we still had to get him back to Wetlands in Tribeca. It wasn't actually that far, maybe 20 or 30 minute walk. In the middle of all this Halloween madness, the seas just parted, and Lee Perry walked right through.
Milarepa by Michael Diamond. The Bodhisattva vow means striving for enlightenment, to better help all other sentient beings attain enlightenment. That's an important issue, the objective of that vow. Being enlightened is the best way to benefit all other beings. From that place, you're able to help more. And it clicked in my head. I thought I need to write a song about this. Adam Yauch, Tricycle, The Buddhist Review, Winter 1994. This is about Yauch and how he found something that made so much sense to him he could actually believe in it. When he was a kid, his parents would take him on trips to Mexico, Italy, and other places that weren't Brooklyn or Manhattan. He became interested in seeing the world and how other people live in it. By the time we started making music for what would become Trick Your Head, we'd gotten used to him showing up at the studio only to get a phone call from a friend about snowfall in Utah that would throw him into a panic, and he'd be on a flight the next morning. Around 1990, he'd gotten to India and Nepal. To us, while this fit his nomadic ways, it was next level far and hard to comprehend at first. While trekking in the Nepalese Himalayas, he met Tibetans in exile who told him what life was like for them under Chinese rule. He was moved by their vow of nonviolence in response to cruelty and oppression, their generous outlook, their belief in interconnectedness through past, present, and future lives. Upon his return, we could see that Adam wanted to understand this vow of nonviolence. Why did they choose not to fight back against a government that would beat and imprison a person just for waving a Tibetan flag? He wanted to know more, so he traveled to India a few more times. In Dharamsala, he began his studies of Tibetan Buddhist philosophy and practices. He drank yak butter tea with the monks and loved watching them debate one another in their customary style. He saw how laughter was a staple of their lives. Then he wanted to share this information. He went to Arizona in 1993, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama was giving teachings. The people that I've met are really centered in the heart. They're coming from a real clear, compassionate place. And most of the teachings that I've read about almost seem set up to distract the other side of your brain in order to give your heart center a chance to open up. In terms of what I understand, Buddhism is like a manual to achieve enlightenment. There are these five things and these six things within the first thing, and all these little subdivisions, and despite all of that right brain information, it's very heart-centered. At least that's the feeling I get from the Tibetans. Also, the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism have been passed down for a long time now. They have that system pretty well figured out. Adam Yauch, Tricycle, The Buddhist Review, Winter, 1994. He started writing lyrics and making songs that incorporated his new life findings, his new understanding of the connectedness of all things. He sampled Tibetan monks chanting for our song Shambhala on Ill Communication and wanted to donate some of the proceeds to an organization that could raise awareness for the Tibetans' situation.
No one remembers that Yauch had Tibetan monks do a morning prayer on stage to open the Lollapalooza tour. It was out there and amazing. Watching the confusion on the faces of thousands of American kids who wanted to get a good spot for the Smashing Pumpkins and instead saw a dozen Tibetan monks chanting in prayer was fantastic. Playing basketball and video games with monks is pretty fun, but crying with laughter while sliding down a water slide together is an experience that I can't believe we were lucky enough to have.
Unable to find a nonprofit that met his criteria, what did Yauch do? He started one. A nonprofit organization called the Milarepa Fund, which would oversee how the money got distributed. And what he did next was global. He wanted to spread the word far and wide about the plight of the people of Tibet and their message of nonviolence. With the help of our longtime managers, John Silva and John Cutcliffe, Yauch organized the Tibetan Freedom Concert, a massive two-day benefit in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco in 1996. A huge outdoor festival with mega bands like Red Hot Chili Peppers and Rage Against the Machine. It was the biggest charity concert since Live Aid. What he did was historic. The next year, he organized an even bigger Tibetan Freedom Concert on Randall's Island in New York. Then, in 1998, a two-day festival in the 50,000-seat RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. Free Tibet 99 was actually four concerts on the same day internationally. Hundreds of thousands of people had Free Tibet on their tongues and heard the call for nonviolence because of that guy in Beastie Boys. The choice today is no longer between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. Martin Luther King Jr.
Mixmaster Mike, the Draco Report.
Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, June 20th, 1995. I first encountered humanoid subject number A718, Adam Yauch, at a youth gathering in Earth's subsector, NY212-B. My mission was to observe and engage in human relational protocol at a location known as Rocksteady Park. The proceedings were referred to as a hip-hop jam. My initial transmissions with Earth's inhabitants were via the scratch communication device. In this gathering of people in metaphysical form, I warned subject number A718 of his planet's impending danger from the Draco constellation. For generations, the beings of Draco have threatened the demise of this Earthling communication known as hip-hop. I offered our initial schematics of the Zectar turntable and impressed upon him that its ultrasonic frequency rays were certain to have the capability to quell Draco's hostility. Before beaming back to substation 916-C, Sacramento, California, number A718 and I exchanged micron slips containing our digitational data. Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, August 3rd, 1995. Several Earth days ago, I sent an audio transmission or answering machine message to subject number A718. It contained a brief example of my tactical tweak scratch skills using the Technique and Newmark devices. I am still awaiting a response transmission. Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, April 11, 1996. I received correspondence from number A718. He and his squadron had formed a secret alliance known as Quasar, and they were to give a lecture on the human topic, punk music, in close proximity to substation 916-C. Contact was initiated, Earth time, 9:14:07 p.m. The location of our deliberation took place at an exercise facility referred to as a skate park. There we strengthened communication and locked in plans to join forces. Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, November 4th, 1997. During my research and strategizing plan for the anti-theft device mechanism inside the DS-1 orbital battle station, I received another transmission from subject number A718. He agreed that the situation involving the Draco constellation was dire, and we began laying the groundwork for our first strategic sonic strike entitled Codename Hello Nam Nam. 7 Earth days hence, Beastie drone forces landed on the rooftop of DS-1 orbital and transported me to subsector NY212-M Manhattan. Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, January 2nd, 1998. We docked an audio sound station Barracuda beneath a large mass of H2O named the Hudson River. It was there that we devised our first offensive strike. With a few simple modifications on the original Proton-K scratch, we reformed the Zectar turntable's usage in the form of the tweak scratch. Subject number A718 His squadron and I were successful in our first audio attempt, given the human name 3MCs and 1DJ. It was a crushing blow to the Draco Alliance, and a peaceful resolution was reached. Planetary Surveillance, Earth Human, DJ MMM Chronicle Entry, Earth Date, September 14, 2018. Fueled by Krispy Kreme donuts, games of Boggle, and injections of iced coffee, I find it difficult to return to the Zectar coordinate at this current date. I would like to request an extension to continue my research here on planet Earth.
Hello Nasty is Our Best Record by Adam Horovitz, read by Rachel Maddow. Hello Nasty is our best record, and I'm going to prove it to you if you believe otherwise. Number one, it has 22 songs on it, the most we have ever put on a record, so you really get your money's worth, making it our most financially advantageous product in the marketplace. You may love Erykah Badu or the Eagles, but Beastie Boys gives you more music for the same price. Number two, upon its release, it received a staggering amount of praise and accolades in the media. I just looked on Wikipedia, and it says that Hello Nasty not only ranked as the number 22 best record of the year in Germany's Music Express, and number 44 in France's Les Inrecuptibles, but it received a B+ from Entertainment Weekly magazine, and a 7 out of 10 from something called Pop Matters. So deal with that, Sean Paul and Adele and Mumford & Sons, too. Number three, it has the song Intergalactic, and that song is the fucking jam, right? Number four, it really is a weird record. Not a why be normal, fake weird, but it's actually weird for the top 40 pop music medium, especially in the late 90s. Most bands don't let themselves get loose. They stay in their lane. Since The Clash, name another band that sounds like a few different bands all on the same record. Number five. Hello Nasty is more mixtape than record, a gift from us to you. When you get a sec, listen to the songs Song for Junior, Song for the Man, Sneaking Out the Hospital, I Don't Know, and Body Movin'. Are those songs supposed to be by the same band on the same record? Well, the wonderful people of Switzerland say yes, because on Wikipedia it says that Hello Nasty was number one on the fucking Swiss charts. So wrap that around your brain, Tool. Celine Dion and Fetty Wap. Number six. Maybe this isn't a reason for you to think Hello Nasty is our best record, but does it help you to know that it's my favorite? I love all the records we made, but this one is just a little more special to me. It was recorded during some major transitional life moments for the three of us. It started at G-Sun in Los Angeles. It ended on 12th Street in Manhattan, New York City, in the same building as my first ever New York grown-up apartment. Things just felt very full circle-ish. We were back in New York, we were still family, and we were still a New York City band. We shared a practice space with my friend Michael Rohatyn in a sub-sub basement room on Mott Street. It was the New York City version of G-Sun, except G-Sun was big and open and had an indoor basketball court. Mott Street was tiny and cramped and had water bugs and a serious mold infestation. It almost felt like a gross practice space in a submarine, the kind of gross where when you blow your nose, dirt comes out. It was perfect for me, and I loved it. I would ride my bike there across Bleecker Street every day and make music. A lot of times I'd be by myself, just recording drums or piano or guitar into the tape machine, press play and record on the Tascam DA88 tape deck, run back behind the instrument, and scramble to get the headphones on in time to start playing. Adam and Mike would do the same, and it was really cool to show up by yourself, to work by yourself, and hear what the other two had done the day or night before, by themselves. You'd add some little thing to the thing they were working on, or start some new idea for them to listen to and add to. It was a new and exciting way for us to make music. Number seven, it's our best record cover slash artwork. We were stuck on what the cover should be, and so we had a show-and-tell presentation of other record covers we liked, and talked about them. Like, it should be a picture like this. No, what if it was more like that? And then Mario Caldado blurted out, yo, the cover should be a picture of the three of you guys packed in a sardine can. Of course it should. It was staring us in the face the whole time. We asked Michael Levine, a photographer, a friend of a friend, to shoot the shot. And he did. It was, and he is, great. Our friend Bill McMullen and Yauch created the inside image, Our Other World. This was a throwback to when people used to listen to records and stare at the artwork and think about the band being otherworldly. The Check Your Head collage artwork was an invitation or an insight into our little circle of friends and family. But Hello Nasty was where we were headed. Interplanetary and outer space. Uranus. Number 8. Sneaking Out the Hospital is your favorite song title ever. Number 9. The song Dedication is SBIA. So bad it's awesome. That's why it's on the record. Number 10. Hello Nasty is our best record to me also because it was the end of an era. It was the beginning of a new chapter, sure, but after this, things were different. After this, we were grown-ups, not as dumb. After this, we'd get called sir at a coffee shop by some fucking asshole barista shithead that I just wanted a coffee from and not a whole lengthy situation. You know what I mean. After this, we kind of knew what we were doing. After this, we started to have kids and actual responsibilities. After this was totally great and new and exciting, but after this was also kind of just after this. Shit got really real. After this, September 11th happened. Sandy Hook happened. Ferguson happened. Orlando happened. And, oh God, Donald Trump happened. Innocence passed at such a mass and rapid rate that after this, there was only looking back at this. Hello Nasty was recorded all over New York City. We'd moved from L.A. and didn't have our own studio, so we asked around to see if anyone had space somewhere that we could borrow. And to our rescue came Sean Lennon, one of the most genuinely nice people I know. We were just becoming friends with him, Chip Amato, Sonic Youth, the John Spencer Blues Explosion, etc. Sean had a practice space that belonged to his dad, and he said we could set up there for a few weeks. Not only was it incredibly nice of him, the space was fucking awesome. A big soundproof room in Soho that we could all walk to and make a ton of noise in at night. Not to mention that there was gear in there, like a couple guitars and a Rhythm Ace drum machine that each had a little 70s-style red label on it that read, John Lennon. It's pretty amazing to think that while I was using a big plastic label maker to make red labels on my bicycle and stuff so my brother and sister wouldn't mess with them, John Lennon was doing the same thing to his stuff. We got to do the thing I'd always wanted to do as a band, have a bunch of places listed on the liner notes that we recorded at to make the record. We made demos at our apartments, as well as an office Sean's mom had but didn't use very much. We rented a studio on Spring Street and 6th Avenue, but it was only available for 2 to 3 weeks. Mike's brother David was out of town for a couple weeks, so we set up there, too. Mike, I'm assuming he knew we were doing this, right? We also recorded for months at our dungeon studio on Mott Street. We ended up booking a real studio to finish it, RPM Studios, on East 12th Street. We spent a lot of time and money at RPM, but it was worth it, as this is our best record, right? And not for nothing, the guy that owned the studio was with Robert Moog when he/they invented the first polyphonic synthesizer. So there's that. Remote control. I made the basic demo of this on a cassette 4-track tape recorder at home. Adam and Mike liked it enough that we re-recorded it as a band. It needed lyrics, and it was decided that Mike would take the lead. The problem was that he had just gotten a cell phone that had this new text messaging feature that he was obsessed with. He wouldn't put his new communication toy down, so me and Adam made Mike sit in a vocal booth with a tape of the song so he could listen to it over and over and write lyrics. We took away his phone and said he couldn't have it back until he was done. When he emerged from the closet-sized room, he'd written one of my favorite songs of ours. Focus is not Mike's strong point, but when forced, he can be magnificent. Sneaking Out the Hospital. This is one of the few songs of ours where I play the bass and drums. I'm telling you this not because I'm a mediocre bass player or because I can't keep time as a drummer, but because this song is special to me. It's one of the ones that I basically made by myself. I knew that Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder would often record a bunch of instruments on their records, so why not me too? Because of my sloppy drumming, this song has a different kind of funky to it than our other instrumentals. I Don't Know, with Miho Hattori. I love this song not so much for the song itself, but more for what it represents. Yauk pushing our band forward into new directions. Electrify. The main loop from this song is from the soundtrack to the Broadway smash hit Company. Collecting cheap used records for the purpose of finding samples is like being a 5-year-old kid who can buy 50 boxes of Cracker Jacks. You keep opening those shits and get a prize every time. I can't tell you how often I'd get home and listen to records I had just purchased at a Salvation Army and cry tears of joy after finding just one glorious bar of music to loop over and over. If you have a friend named Bobby or Rob, the first song on the Company soundtrack is the funniest song you've ever heard. When you get a sec, you should really go and listen to it. Picture This, with Brooke Williams. This is another song that I played all the instruments on, down in the dungeon. I'm not telling you that because I'm full of myself. I am, but that's beside the point. What I'm saying is, and I know it may sound weird, but it took me a really long time to admit to myself that I was a musician. Making music by myself in the dungeon is what, in my mind, transformed me from being just a guy in a band to being someone who's confident when writing the word musician next to the word occupation on a piece of paper. I was hanging out with my friend Brooke, and she showed me this cool portable Fender reverb box she would always sing her vocals through, no matter where she was. Gigs, studios, home demo tapes, etc. I asked her to write lyrics and sing on this track, and for lack of a better term, she killed it through her portable reverb box. Picture This really reminds me of a beautiful summer's day looking out of a half-open window at the grimy glory that is New York City.
Yoshimi O, Stop Soba Violence, read by Yoshimi O and Kim Gordon. I still don't know why I got punched.
Whenever
the Beasties came to Japan, we would always go shopping for electronics and clothing, and then eat at a soba stand. I have fond memories of doing this with them often.
で、東京の新宿の立ち食いそば屋にビースティと友人たちと立ち寄ったよ。食券買って店に入るなり、私は見知らぬおっさんにいきなりぶん殴られました。
So as usual, we went to a soba stand in Shinjuku, Tokyo with some friends. We bought our meal tickets, and as soon as I walked into the restaurant, an old man I'd never seen before appeared out of nowhere and suddenly punched me.
私は何が起こったのかわからず、そのベロベロに怒ったおっさんの胸ぐらを掴んだや否や。タイムボムレコードの社長の小玉くんが、そのおっさんを間髪入れず殴り倒し。
I didn't know what had happened, but I grabbed the shirt of the drunken old man.Then Kodama, the owner of Time Bomb Records, stepped in and punched the dude.
サーストンムーアはまだ小さいココを抱えてすぐ外に出て、マイク D もアドロックも今はいないけどアダムも豆デポを食らったような顔をしつつ、私をかばい。
Thurston Moore quickly grabbed Coco, who was a toddler, and stepped outside. Mike D, Adrock, and Yauk were in total shock.But they also came in and helped me.
何が一体どうなった?って、みんなの頭にハテナマークが浮かび上がってる時に。
What just happened? Everyone was thinking the same thing, and our heads were filled with question marks.
一番気が確かなのはキム・ゴードンだった。ねえ、ヨシミ。あの厨房の人が履いてる白いブーツはとってもクールだわ。
The one who remained calm through the whole incident was Kim Gordon. She came up to me and said, Hey, Yoshimi, those white boots that the people working in the kitchen wear look so cool.
次の日、私とキムはその厨房の人が履いていたブーツ、白い業務用ゴム長靴を買いにショッパー仲間として東京をさまよいました。
So the next day we went searching around Tokyo to find the industrial white rubber boots that the kitchen workers were wearing.
I still don't know why I got punched that day. Stop Soba Violence.
What a classic song.
...808, A Roy Choi Cookbook. Yo, I was 15, maybe 16, afternoon, after school, late afternoon, burgundy Nissan with the snug top, 15-inch deep dish, carpeted truck bed with four 15-inch woofers in the back, so the 808 kick drum was booming. It was in his garage, my boy Carlos, my DJ, but I was no rapper. Carlos and I were inseparable at this time, always kicking it. He hardly ever drove his whip, so it was always in his garage, and we just sat in it, not getting it dirty, listening to music, smoking weed, talking shit. The truck was so low to the ground that when you sat in it, you could lounge your leg out the door and it would just be flush with the ground, like sitting on the floor watching TV with them funny-shaped back pillow things from the 70s with the armrests that were shaped like a rhino. There was a lot of West Coast stuff being played at this time, as we sat for hours in a car that never moved, listening to Egyptian Lover or Rodney Owen, Joe Cooley, waiting for his mom's Chili Verde to be done, never thinking about our homework. Then he put that tape in. This was the moment, I think, a part of my life changed. Here's a little story I've got to tell about three bad brothers you know so well. It started way back in history with Ad-Rock, MCA, and me, Mike D. Then everything shook. We bugged the fuck out. The bass changed everything within me, and we turned it up and up and up and up and popped a woofer and still turned it up. That was the first time I had heard Beastie Boys. I'd seen them on Crush Groove by that time, but I wasn't really paying attention, not only to them, but to anything really. I wasn't interested in anything but spacing out at that time and losing myself in a sea of bass. And Paul Revere that day warped me, and the Chili Verde never tasted so good. As I grew, so did my taste buds. I found new buds, drank more than just bud, smoked better bud, but the White Castle and the sound of Paul Revere were the beginning of that. I followed the music and the culture from there on, of course. Paul's Boutique to Grand Royal to Extra Large to Mixmaster Mike to Sabotage to all the weirdness in between. I got lost in the videos, then I just got lost as a 20-something. Then I found cooking. In kitchens, we always play music, most of the time on shitty systems with shitty speakers, and now as times have grown, a lot on phones propped up on the past by a kitchen towel. Why we don't invest in better speakers and systems as chefs and cooks in the kitchen, I'll never know. Maybe it's because we're just gypsies like that, always on the run, moving from kitchen to kitchen, working our ass off, and just being in the moment. What's great about cooking in restaurants is you spend hours standing around together, working and focusing. Time unfolds, and you have nowhere to be except there with each other in the kitchen. I mention this because it is a perfect place to play albums out in their entirety. There was a lot of Beasties in my kitchen. So I'm older now, been through some amazing twists and turns. I'm still humble, but shit don't surprise me no more. I expect the unexpected to happen, but I never expected to meet Mike D. But I did. In my restaurant A-frame and my stupid ass playing So What You Want, loud as fuck to see if it was really him. I told my staff, yo, that's Mike D. And they kept doubting me, so I played it. No reaction. But I knew it was him, so we kept turning it up, like in the burgundy Nissan, and I kept pummeling the table with food until I got the courage to say what up. And it was him. And we clicked right in the moment. And now I'm here writing a cookbook for you to cook from in this Beastie Boys book. Trip the fuck out. Ooh-wee! Paul's Boutique has so much food. I love this album because it thinks like a cook. Not in just the food references, but in what the album did after the success of License to Ill. As cooks and chefs, we love to take the most popular things off the menu because in many cases they weren't meant to incite that certain reaction or to become popular in the first place. We are a very neurotic tribe, and seeing our food become stale and looking at it every day can be tough because we as cooks have moved on so much as our struggles with flavor and development are constantly shifting. We love those dishes that become standards that everyone wants to come back for. But sometimes, we just want to remove them all and make a Paul's Boutique. Eggman. The egg, a symbol of life. Go inside your house and bust out your wife. Pulled out the jammy, he thought it was a joke. The trigger I pulled is face the yolk. This is going to be a trippy one. Egg on egg on egg on egg with egg garnish. But you can do it because you're the egg man. Make this shit with a dozen eggs. 6 for the omelets and 6 for the fried, plus 2 more for the hard-boiled yolk. Quarter cup of milk, salt and pepper, olive oil, butter, box of sea urchin uni, tin of caviar or a jar of salmon eggs, or what's also called ikura. First, hard-boil 2 eggs in boiling water for 10 minutes, then cool completely. Peel and remove the hard yolk and run the yolk through a strainer or a sieve to get powdered yolk. A microplane works best. Now with 6 eggs with a quarter cup of milk and season heavily with salt and pepper. Heat a nonstick pan to low medium and dab some olive oil and a couple knobs of butter. Pour in the eggs and shake and swirl. Then use a rubber spatula to keep shaking till it's a soft scramble. Then let it set for a second, fold it over into an omelet and put it on a large plate. Now wipe that pan and add a touch of olive oil and butter again and crack the other 6 eggs in and cook them sunny side up. Shingle each egg on top of the omelet in a row. Now layer the uni and dollops of fish eggs on top of the eggs. Then garnish the whole thing with the powdered egg yolk. Boom! Crack on your forehead, here's a towel, now wipe. The sounds of science. Noggles, Isaac Newton, and Scientific Easy. Ben Franklin with the kite, getting over with the key. Cheech Wizard in a snow blizzard, eating chicken gizzards with a girl named Lizzie. Dropping science like Galileo dropped the orange. All I can think is tacos when I see these rhymes. I think beer, naranjas, tacos, late nights, dusty roads, bean burritos, and Newports. That's what I think of. My friends used to work at a Noggles in Anaheim, and we used to go through the drive-thru yelling into the speaker, buying one burrito at a time, then going back around into the drive-thru again and again till we filled our order. Stupid hungry stoner shit. Chicken gizzard tacos, otherwise known as butthole bites. 1 pound of chicken gizzards, 1 cup of peeled garlic pureed, 1 tablespoon Korean chili powder, coarse ground, 1 tablespoon roasted sesame seeds, 4 tablespoons sesame oil, 4 tablespoons vegetable oil, salt and pepper to taste. Soak the gizzards for a couple hours in cold water and let sit. Then drain, rinse, and dry. Mix the gizzards with all the other ingredients, then fry in a pan till cooked. Should take about a few minutes on each side. Onion mix. Mince an onion with a cup of chopped cilantro and squeeze the juice of a lime in with salt and pepper. Heat up some corn tortillas and fill the tacos with the gizzards. Garnish with shredded cheese, tapatio hot sauce, and the minced onion mix. Car thief. See? I'm a city slicker. I ain't no townie. Right now, I wish I had another hash brownie. I grew up in the era of hash and shrooms. Now it's edibles and dab. We didn't have much money back then, so the resin was gold, too. Scraping pipes, saving resin, unrolling roaches, and rolling resin-lined second-hand joints. I don't know. It was like my mise en place. It's like cooking, like storage, like fermentation, like pickling. I basically do the same shit now in my kitchen. Not with weed, but with food. Layering, scraping, saving, rotating, using everything. Let's make brown burgers. 4 Idaho potatoes, washed and peeled and soaked in water. 1 onion pureed in a blender with a touch of water. Touch of olive oil, lots of butter, salt and pepper to taste. 12 ounces hamburger meat, 8 slices American cheese, ketchup and mustard. Grate the potatoes into clear water with a hand grater. Drain them and mix with onion puree. Heat a large pan or griddle to medium heat. Add oil and some butter. Layer the potato mixture in the pan or the griddle, gently in one even layer. Turn the flame down to a low medium and chill. Season the potatoes heavily with salt and pepper and knobs of butter. When the bottom is deep golden brown, flip and season and add more butter. In a bowl, mix the burger meat, then season with salt and pepper and a touch of mustard. In a separate pan or griddle, or the same griddle, heat to medium, form 4-ounce patties, and start to cook with some oil and butter. flip the burger and add 2 slices of cheese. Just as the burger is ready, layer on top of the hash browns and squirt in some ketchup and mustard. Now you can serve it open-faced like this, or cut the damn thing down the middle and fold it over so the crispy potatoes are the buns. Either way, it's pretty stony. Get it together. Gotta do it like this, like Chachi and Joni, cause she's the cheese and I'm the macaroni. I eat the fucking pineapple now and laters. Listen to me now, don't listen to me later. I'm thinking the streets, smelling from skating all day, pants sagging, sun shining, wearing tropical colors and puppy love like a dog. Barbecue grilled cheese. Loaf of white bread or sourdough, 1 cup of butter softened. Macaroni, 1/2 pound macaroni boiled and cooled. You know how to do it. Just the noodles though. 1/2 pound shredded cheddar melted over a low flame with 1/2 cup of milk. Mix those two together in reserve. Barbecue sauce. Use the store-bought barbecue sauce. 1 pineapple peeled and cored. 4 tablespoons olive oil. Drizzle pineapple with olive oil. Sprinkle with a touch of sugar and salt. Then roast at 350 degrees till brown and soft. Maybe 30 minutes or so. Take it out and puree in a blender with a splash of water. Add this pineapple mixture to the barbecue sauce and incorporate. Spread the soft butter on the outside of the bread slices, layer with the macaroni mixture inside, then drizzle the barbecue sauce all over the mac and close the sandwich. Cook the sandwich on a griddle on low till crispy on each side. Bomb. Don't play no game that I can't win. You try to play to win, but now you lost like clams with no tartar sauce. I'm a tartar sauce fiend. One of those little sauce cups will never do when I'm eating fried stuff. I truly don't understand how restaurants think it could. Let's do a big bowl of clams as if it were a pool of tartar sauce. For the tartar sauce, 2 cups of heavy cream, 1 cup of capers with juice, juice of 2 lemons, 1 cup of minced chives, 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, 1/2 cup of minced pickles, splash of hot sauce, 1 teaspoon of ground black pepper. Whisk all the ingredients together. For the bowl of clams, olive oil, 1/2 pound of clams washed, 1/2 cup of minced shallots, bottle of really, really good white wine, salt and pepper, knob of butter, 1 cup chopped flat leaf parsley. Heat a big pot with some olive oil. Add the clams and shallots, then cook about a minute till it's really hot. Douse in about 1/2 your bottle of wine and drink the other 1/2. Cover the pot and reduce the flame to medium. In a few minutes, take off the top. The clam should be open. Season with salt and pepper, add the tartar sauce mixture and reduce. Continue to shake the pot and move the clams around with the spoon. Add a knob of butter, turn off the flame, add the parsley, and don't put in a sauce cup. You can eat this right out of the pot or put it in a large bowl and be primal. A good baguette would be nice. 1 potato chip. I want to end this with the first conversation I had with Ad Rock and Mike D about this book, The Devil's in the Details. How simplicity and attention to fundamentals can turn a single potato chip into a life-changing moment. That's cooking. I guess that's my quote, Roy Choi. 1 Idaho potato, washed and peeled, a big pot of hot oil, salt and pepper. Slice that potato very thin, like paper thin, like rice paper thin. Like seeing through the veil of all of your insecurities thin. Real thin. The oil should be at 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Lay the potato slices in 1 at a time very gently. Only as many as you think you can handle at a time. Keep moving and flipping those chips and watching very carefully. As soon as they turn golden, take those fuckers out. Put on a paper towel lined tray and season immediately. Game over. Peace up, out, and all around. To Mike D, Ad Rock, MCA, and you know, we can't, we won't, and we don't stop. Poppy.
Approximately Grown-Ups by Michael Diamond. After Hello Nasty came out and Intergalactic started doing well, it became clear we'd be doing another tour of arenas. We started to think about possible ways to make the shows a little more immediate and in-your-face even, instead of being little ants on a stage at one end of the building with the sound echoing around everywhere. An idea was floated. What about putting the stage in the middle of a floor as opposed to at one end, like the sporting events these arenas were built for in the first place? We quickly concluded that it made sense just based on simple math. You're cutting by half the maximum distance away from us that any one person could be, and doubling the number of good seats. So we decided, okay, we're playing in the middle. The obvious next problem was that you couldn't just play facing one side the whole time. The show had to be equally good whichever side of the building you were on. That's how the idea of playing in the round came about. All the instruments would be placed near the center of the stage, and the center would rotate 90 degrees every 10 minutes or so. So every audience member got four different perspectives in equal measure. Around the moving center was a stationary ring, separated by an inch or two from the moving part that we could step onto and MC from when we weren't playing our instruments, while running around to all sides of the audience. We called it the In the Round Tour. We meant that to be a little ironic. We felt a little self-conscious, like we were becoming Yes or something. Once the tour started and we played a few shows, it became clear that the setup solved the previously mentioned problems very well. It was nothing like going to see AC/DC or Eric Clapton, but practically speaking, there was definitely a learning curve for us. It was weird. After 15 years on conventional stages, you're not used to worrying about somebody looking at your ass, or how gross and sweaty the back of your shirt is, or how stupid some dance will look to anyone not directly in front of you. We just felt more exposed, and we hadn't considered that since we'd changed, the way we were perceived would change too. There was no place for us to hide while talking with each other on stage. No mid-show me time. I'd like to say that we also did a lot of glute work to make it a better experience for the audience and for us, but that didn't happen. The audience probably suffered. For whatever reason, maybe because Intergalactic was a pop hit, we had more women at our shows this time around, and fewer of the overexcited aggro dudes that had been a staple of the Check Your Head and Ill Communication tours. The scene backstage was different as well. Yauk brought his wife, Dechen, and their newborn on tour. My wife, Tamara, and Adam's then-girlfriend, now-wife, Kathleen, were around.
I have a specific memory of a show in San Francisco where I noticed that there was maybe four toddlers in our dressing room. They were on the floor playing with cars or trains or something. There were more little kids playing than there were grown-ups getting drunk. Times changed, and it was nice.
For the first time, we had a family bus. On this bus, it was me, Yauk, his wife, and daughter, and our tour manager, Robert. Horowitz was definitely not on the family bus. He was on the pothead bus. Money Mark would go back and forth between the two. Tamara and I would go on to have two boys who grew up their first few years touring around with us. For the rest of our time together as a band, we'd bring our families and kids on the road. It was almost like we'd gone and become grown-ups. Well, almost.
That's the Life I Wanted, by Adam Horowitz, read by Chuck D. So one summer morning in 1998, I woke up in a hotel room in Kansas City. I had nothing to do all day until the show that night. I did what Michael Sweet, Lou Diamond, and I usually do on days off. Looked through the phone book to find record stores and thrift stores. I went down to the front desk with my phone book list of potential crate digger gold mines and asked if any of the places on my list were nearby the hotel. You could really get a nice tourist view of a town or a city by doing this. Almost never is there goodwill with great records listed in the Folders Travel Guide to Davenport, Iowa. Outside bigger cities, good used record stores are usually near college or on a street that has the town's only cool coffee shop. You know the ones where Dave Matthews Band is playing on the radio and the walls are decorated with paintings with shards of broken plates glued to them. It was a sunny summer weekday morning in Kansas City, nice and quiet. I took a taxi from the hotel to the most promising sounding store on my list. Places called something like Bill's Records or Sound Exchange are usually a good bet. The place that always tops the list for me is a used bookstore, used record store combo. They always have jazz records. They almost always have at least one early 70s record on the CTI or Groove Merchant labels that I don't have. Some Monk Higgins-ish record with a song on it called, like, Bumpin'. This Kansas City morning cab ride dropped me off outside the Music Exchange. It was massive by New York City standards, a big, wide-open space with just bins and bins of records. And they had everything. Not just jazz and soul, but great rock records too. Like, if you were looking for the record by one of Billy Joel's first bands, Attila, I bet they had it. And for cheap too. My favorite part about this place was that no one else was in there. Just me and the records. Private sifting. I was quietly happy going through the aisles, filling up the record covers, when I heard an intensely funky breakbeat playing faintly through the store's speakers, high up there on the walls. I looked around the place and wondered, where? Why? How is this happening? Was it just in my head? No. At the back of the store, behind the counter, was the one other person in this huge room of rows of bins, and he was sitting down looking, pointing directly at me, and he was laughing. I stopped, turned, and fucking speed walked right up to him and asked about the beat. He said, oh, you don't have this? The perfect response from any collector of anything. I said, no. He casually said, it's the Niagara beat. Like I'm supposed to know what that is. Shit. I am supposed to know what that is. What is it? I want it. He told me he couldn't sell it to me because it was his. He explained that his job at the store was to buy the used records from the people who bought them in to sell. Because these CD things had taken over, so they didn't want their big bulky records anymore. Or they needed money. Or drugs. Or money for drugs. Or they had outstanding hospital bills, or, damn, you can't even think about that now. Stop thinking of all the potential depressing scenarios that drive people to sell their stuff they used to love. Some people just don't care about records anymore, and for sure could use a couple extra bucks that selling them will bring, right? When the really good shit got brought into the store, he kept it for himself. I couldn't argue with that. Especially since this place had a fucking endless amount of great records. The store had hundreds of DeWolf Music Library records.
Library records are a collection of little one-minute pieces for soundtracks recorded by session musicians for movies, TV, student films, or whatever. I don't actually know the story behind when, why, or where they were made, but there were a bunch of different labels that made them, and still probably do. And I was on the hunt for any recorded between 1969 and 1976. They all have random song titles like Bouncy Strut, with descriptions like hard driving beat with percussion, so imagine how much funky shit is on them. For me, DeWolf Music was the best. Maybe it was because they had the best artwork.
Since no one else was in the store, this guy had plenty of free time to bullshit about records and bands and stuff, as did I. My friends, bandmates were probably still sleeping back at the hotel while all this was happening. I was really happy that I went on a solo mission. A Tribe Called Quest was on tour with us too, and I played enough basketball with Q-Tip to know he can box out. Today, I wanted my own personal sifting space. I could have called Michael Sweet, Lou Diamond, or Fredo, or Mixmaster Mike, or Allie from Tribe to tell them about what I discovered. But you know what? Forget those guys. These records were mine. The record store guy, who had now introduced himself to me as Dante Carfagna, was fucking schooling me on all this stuff that I should have known. Records I never knew existed, kind of blowing my mind with music knowledge. We hung out at the store for a while, and then he said he was going to go on a break soon. Did I want to grab a coffee and some snacks and go to his house around the corner and listen to records? Hell yes. We walked a couple of blocks to his house, a nice little two-story house with a front and backyards, and he said that his rent was $250 a month. So I'm thinking, if I was him, I could wake up in the morning, go get some good coffee, go to a great record store, sift through unknown potential gems all day, go home, smoke pot, listen to more records, and then do it all over again the next morning. That's the life I wanted. I wonder how he felt about mine.
Five Borough Breakdown by Adam Horovitz. Similar, but so dissimilar, to the License to Ill tour, Hello Nasty had spun into another type of whirlwind for us. It took us around the world again, but in a larger way than ever. By then, we had a string of records out and a few hit songs that people were psyched to see and hear us perform. We sold out the Garden in a day, We weren't just the Fight for Your Right one-hit wonders anymore. Out were the wild tour days of beer-soaked shirts and freak shows. In were private chefs on tour, sightseeing and family fun backstage. The only real similarities about those two tours were that me, Adam, and Mike were together having fun, and it was all-consuming. We lived and breathed music while making Hello Nasty, and were away from home playing music almost nonstop for 2 years after it was released. We had booked a co-headlining tour with Rage Against the Machine for the summer of 2000, but we had to cancel it because Mike broke his collarbone. Mike and Tamara were riding bikes up University Place, and Mike hit a pothole in the street. His front tire went in, and he was upended off the bike and came slamming down onto the concrete. Tamara said that when he stood up, his collarbone was sticking up out of his shirt. Mike said, "I'm fine. I'm just going to lay down here on the sidewalk and take a little rest." He was way too fucked up to go on tour and play drums and jump around every night, so please don't be mad that we canceled those shows. They would have been fun, but come on. Can you please just think about Mike's well-being for a moment?
First, I would like to second Adam's depiction here. He actually gets it right for a change. He's really showing us a compassionate side of himself, and I appreciate that. He really gets me.
The reason I'm telling you all of this is because we took a break from touring for a while, and spent most of 2000 and 2001 in New York doing nothing but being people who watched TV, went on errands, and walked their dogs. It was fantastic to be able to stay put for a real amount of time and not have a suitcase staring at you waiting to leave home once again. But after a while, the fulfillment of going to the hardware store or waiting around for the goddamn fucking Time Warner cable guy to show up wore off, and we wanted to start making music again. Yauk was grossed out by our grimy, waterbug-infested basement below the basement practice space and wanted to get a real studio that we could call our own. A place with a window was all he said he needed. But instead, he found an entire floor in an office building on Canal Street and built a full-blown recording studio. Soundproof room, huge mixing desk, etc. It was perfect for us. Our own place that we could walk to and make music whenever we wanted. It had a big, beautiful window to let light in. On one end, the window looked onto a classic New York City alleyway, and on the other end's window you could see the tops of the World Trade Center. One day we met up to start thinking about what to make, and Yauk declared that whatever our next record was going to be, it had to be an all-rap record. No instrumentals. I don't know what led him to that decision, but that was it. Me and Mike tried to argue with him about it. Why did we have to decide now? Why not just see what happened? But Yauk was not the wavering type. He was the most determined person I knew. Maybe it was something to do with him being an only child, and since Mike and I are both the youngest of three kid families, we're used to not getting our way, or at least giving in to battles that weren't that important to us. I mean, it's always been so much fun making music together, what's the big deal? An all-rap record it is, and we got to work. In the midst of us doing our usual thing, hanging out at the studio, bullshitting, ordering lunch, and making music, September 11th happened. For obvious reasons, it cast a huge shadow over what we were doing. Also, our studio was just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. Suddenly, there were cops and military police on every corner, checkpoints and everything. Walking past guys with assault rifles every day kind of set the tone for an unslap-happy mood. Well, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, fucked-up government policies, racism, hatred, etc. is what set the tone. The dudes with the guns on the corner were just part of it. Rapping about farts and Chef Boyardee in the wake of thousands of people being murdered down the street didn't feel right. Shit got serious, quick. I feel like the record we ended up making, To the Five Boroughs, would have been way better if it wasn't limited to rap songs. Few rappers are successful when trying to get serious, i.e. political. Chuck D comes to mind as one who is. Anyone else? Songs about racism, sexism, homophobia, etc., might have been better screamed in a punk rock style. A good path to creating something mediocre is having rigid rules for what you're making and how you're making it. Unfortunately, this record took a stumble down the path of mediocrity. If you listen to our voices, something's a little off. We sound a little hesitant, right? Rarely do you want to listen to a wishy-washy rapper. The rapper's confidence is usually the thing that draws you in. We got caught in this kind of middle ground gray area of this is a serious song, and this is a funny one. The serious ones feel a little forced, and the funny ones are a little flat. I'm not trying to shit on this record, though. Out of all of the slang phrases that have been introduced in my time here on Earth, dope, fresh, bangin', on